All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it's February 3rd. And we're making pretty good progress toward that first test, but we're going to get the practicums all out of the way before we have the first lecture exam. All right, so we're going to cover integument, maybe start integument today, finish it up next time, and then the week after is your first test. But don't forget you have your practicum started this week, and then that's going to extend until Monday next time. So we were talking about, let me see if I can get these lights straightened out a little bit. We were talking about histology or tissues. What the heck is a tissue? What's a tissue? Yeah, so it's not just one cell, it's a group of cells, right, that all look the same, all function the same, and even the junk in between the cells is the same and has the same function. All right, so that's a tissue. So what's the building block of a tissue?
A cell,
yeah, and you should know what the building block of a cell is. And as a matter of fact, I could ask you, what's a building block of life? That's a cell, right? So try to break things down into building blocks that really helps your appreciation of this topic right here. All right, so for tissues, there are only four major kinds of tissues in the body. Anything can be any, you can point to any place on your body and you should be able to tell me what kind of tissue it is by these four different types. What are the four types of tissues? Epithelium is good to say first, maybe. Connective tissue, muscle, and nervous tissue. So that's the order that we studied them in. You don't have to tell me in that exact order. They're not ordered by any particular rhyme or reason. But you should at least know and never forget those are the four kinds of tissues. Now you got to know something about the subdivisions, right, of these different tissues. So let's start with epithelium. How do you classify an epithelium? By the shape of the cells and then number of layers. But when you look at an epithelium that has a number of layers, the deepest layer might have a different shape than the superficial layer. So how are you going to tell me what kind of epithelium that is? Because it has different kinds. By the apical layer, right? The layer that's on the surface near the free edge of that epithelium is how we designate the name, whether it's cuboidal or squamous or whatever. Yes, indeed. Very good. Okay. And there's one kind of atypical epithelium. Well, maybe two. All right. But two kind of funny types of epithelia that don't fit nice and neat into that strategy that we were just talking about in terms of nomenclature. Ah, somebody said pseudostratified ciliated columnar, right? Because sometimes it looks like a simple layer, sometimes it looks like it has many different layers in there. So pseudostratified is one of those that are kind of funny. What's another funny one?
Transitional,
right? Because those are shapeshifters. They can become very squamous when the bladder is full, and then they turn into like a pillow shape when the bladder is voided. So they're shapeshifter kinds of cells. They change their shape. All right, here's the sign-in sheet for today. So go ahead, sign in, please. Don't forget, this is your receipt that you're in class. And if you don't sign it, then there's no receipt that you were in class and you could be dropped, maybe by accident. But if you don't have a receipt, then I don't know what to tell you, right? So let's just make sure you sign that. All right, so that's epithelium. What's the function of an epithelium? Okay. In terms of structure is the way I'm thinking, not necessarily in terms of function. But if you're thinking in terms of function, that's great. But in terms of structure, I think of an epithelium that is lining a cavity or covering a surface. Right? And so what you were telling me was function, well, that's really the function of epithelium for protection, for instance. That's really important. Okay. But epithelium can also make membranes, and that's one of the last topics that we got to talk about today, are some membranes in the body. All right, so let's move from epithelium to connective tissue. And what's the most important space in a connective tissue? The matrix. It's the extracellular space, right? So there's a big space between cells, and that's what gives that particular connective tissue its characteristics. All right, so tell me a connective tissue that kind of stands out in your mind, and why?
A
Areolar. Why does that stand out in your mind? It's got all three fibers. That's right. It's got collagen and elastic fibers and reticular fibers oriented in all different directions. All right. But what about a really atypical kind of connective tissue? Anybody think of an atypical kind of connective tissue? I didn't quite hear anybody say anything. Hyaline cartilage. Right, hyaline cartilage. All right, that seems kind of typical to me. Why did you think that was atypical? What's atypical about it compared to other kinds of connective tissue? The matrix doesn't have much in the way of fibers, right? Precipitated fibers. They're all soluble, right? And it's mostly just ground substance. Remember, the matrix can have fibers and ground substance, and hyaline cartilage, it's just ground substance and very little fibers. So it's not a very strong connective tissue. But I'm thinking of, for instance, like adipose tissue. That's, to me, in my way of thinking, very atypical. Because why? Can anybody describe to me why I'm thinking that? Because what about the matrix in adipose connective tissue? Not very much connective tissue, and we've been harping all along how important the matrix is for connective tissue. All right, but the adipose, the lipid molecules, are intracellular. They're not in the matrix, so that's kind of an atypical. Another kind of atypical connective tissue would be blood, because the matrix is fluid, so blood can flow. And I don't think I mentioned this, but what do we call the fluid part of blood? That's called plasma, right? And there's another part, the cellular part or formed element part, that contains the cells. And you should know the names of all those different cells, of course. All right, so that then takes us to muscle tissue. And what's the function of all muscle tissue? Primarily is to contract or shorten. All right, it has some other functions, like when it contracts, it generates heat that maintains your body temperature when it's cold out. So there's other kinds of functions for muscle, but it's specialized for contraction. All right, and don't forget, you got three different kinds, and you should know all the characteristics of these three different kinds, as well as know what they look like underneath the light microscope. So some are under voluntary control, which means that you control them with your cerebral cortex. You can cause them. You can wish them to contract. And when those electrical signals from your brain get to skeletal muscle, guess what a skeletal muscle is going to do? It's going to contract. The skeletal muscle can never make up its own mind whether it wants to contract or not. If it gets that signal from your brain, it just contracts. That's not necessarily true for these other kinds of muscles, like smooth muscle. Right? These are under involuntary control, and a smooth muscle, when it gets a stimulus to contract, it can still make up its mind whether it's going to contract or not based on other kinds of things that are happening to it. All right? And we're going to see that smooth muscle is controlled by two separate nervous systems, and so two kinds of signals have to mix together to help guide whether or not a smooth muscle is going to contract. And the same thing for cardiac muscle, too. There are two nervous systems that will guide the heart as to whether it will contract fast or slowly, and the force of contraction as well. Okay. Okay, how would you describe something about cardiac muscle that would distinguish it from other kinds of muscle? As a matter of fact, there is a characteristic that it shares with no other kind of muscle tissue. It doesn't share with skeletal or smooth muscle. And it's the shape of the cell. The shape. It has branches. Yeah, somebody maybe told me, but I didn't quite hear. Yeah, but it's branched. Smooth muscle is not branched. Skeletal muscle is not branched. All right? You could say striated. Cardiac muscle is striated, but that's not a distinguishing feature, because what other kind of muscle is striated? Skeletal muscle. So it has some similarities with skeletal muscle. Okay. All right, nervous tissue is specialized for conducting electrical information very rapidly through your body. It makes up the brain, spinal cord, and nerves that are not part of your brain or spinal cord. And a nerve impulse is something what we call an action potential moving along a nerve cell. And potential just means a voltage. It's just a change in voltage that happens along these cells. And when that voltage changes, along the length of a neuron, we call that an action potential. Action means that something is happening, something's in motion, the voltage is in motion. So we just call that a nerve impulse. And impulses can travel only in one direction. All right, it begins on a dendrite, it moves into the cell body, and then down an axon. So let me see if I can find a picture of a neuron. Okay, so here we see a neuron, a big nucleus right here. This big long projection coming out of this cell right here, this is an axon. These really small ones poking out over here and over here. As a matter of fact, here's a nice illustration. These short ones are what we call dendrites. This right here, the center of mass that contains the nucleus and a bunch of organelles, this is what we call the cell body. And that's got another name. And the name, another name for this part of the cell is called the soma. So guess what soma means? It means body. Right, so soma and body are used interchangeably. And then this long projection right here, this is the axon. So signals always go from dendrites to cell body, then down the axon to the tip of this axon right here, and not backwards. So a neuron is a one-way street. Neurons function nicely when they have the proper support cells around them. So that's the second kind of cell that makes up a nervous tissue. The first kind is a neuron, and the second kind are these support cells. And I think I told you last time, what's the real name for a support cell? Neuroglia or neuroglial cells. All right, neuroglia or neuroglial cells. When we get to nervous system, you'll have to know that. But this is what you would have to know, for instance, for the practicum and on the test. All right, so that's a quick review of some of the cells that we talked about last time. All right, so I guess make sure you know what these different parts of a neuron are. And that's going to take us to membranes, unless somebody has a question about the four basic kinds of tissues in your body and maybe some distinguishing features about different kinds of epithelia, different kinds of connective tissue, different kinds of nervous system cells. Anybody have a question before we move on? No? Okay, let's talk about some membranes. All right, so a membrane is a thin sheet or layer that covers a structure, lines a cavity, and that sounds a whole lot like an epithelium, right? But a membrane is an epithelium that is also associated with some kind of connective tissue, usually areolar connective tissue. That's what a membrane is. All right, so there are two basic kinds of membranes with a number of minor membranes that you find in your body. The first major kind is called a mucous membrane. And you might notice that mucus can be spelled a couple of different ways. Let's see if this works. Mucus could be spelled M-U-C-U-S, or it could be spelled M-U-C-O-U-S. Anybody have a clue why we spell it two different ways? Because sometimes a word can be a noun and sometimes it can be an adjective that's modifying the meaning of another noun, right? So if you're talking about the stuff that's coming out of your nose, that's the physical chemical coming out, right? That's mucus. That's a noun. Mucus is the stuff. Mucus with the O-U-S right here is a modifier of another noun, like mucous membrane, right? O-U-S is modifying what membrane right means. Okay, so mucus with the U-S is a noun, O-U-S is an adjective. So don't forget, spelling is important in here. So mucous membranes, notice that we're modifying membrane right here, so mucus in this title is what? An adjective. All right. The definition of a mucous membrane is that it lines a cavity that is open to the outside world. So you have an oral cavity. Is that open to the outside world? Absolutely. So it has a mucous membrane around it, just by definition. A mucous membrane does not necessarily always have to secrete mucus. Most do, but that's not the definition, right? It just means that it lines a cavity open to the outside world. And The oral cavity is just a continuation of your digestive tract. So your whole digestive tract really is open to the outside world. So it has a mucous membrane that lines it. Respiratory tract has a mucous membrane. All right, so your trachea, your windpipe is open to the outside world, or air couldn't get in there. That has a mucous membrane. The urinary tract is open to the outside world, right? Otherwise, you could never pee. So that has a mucous membrane. All right, and the reproductive tract is as well, right, has a mucous membrane. So any kind of cavity that's open to the outside world has a mucous membrane, as opposed to some cavities that are not open to the outside world. Can anybody tell me a cavity that's not open? Name a cavity not open to the outside world. Abdominal cavity is not open to the outside world. What about cranial cavity? You don't want that one open to the outside world, right? Because you need to have that one protected from bacteria and viruses and things like that. So these have what we call serous membranes around them. A little bit more complicated, okay? And it has three main divisions. A serous membrane has three divisions, while a mucous membrane just has one division. Okay. So some serous membranes we find around the lungs, we call that the pleural membranes. Some can be around the heart, we call those the pericardial membranes. And then if it's around the abdominal pelvic cavity, we call that the peritoneal membrane, right? Because the abdominal cavity and pelvic cavity really is one big cavity, so sometimes we call that the peritoneal cavity. All right, so what are the three kinds of membranes that, or the three structures that make up a serous membrane? All right, so here are the divisions, and then I'll show you some pictures. And you actually have a nice video online that shows you how these things develop. All right. All right, so we're going to be thinking about organs that are inside, say, the pleural cavity. What's the organ inside the pleural cavity? The lung. So you have some lungs. There's a membrane that's right on the surface of the lungs, and we call that the visceral serous membrane because the lungs are what we call a visceral organ. They're deep inside a cavity that's not open to the outside world. So that's a visceral membrane. All right, and then you have the wall of the thorax, the chest wall, that has another membrane on it, but we call that the parietal serous membrane. So you got the visceral right on the organ, you got the parietal on the body wall, and of course you got a space in between them, and that's the third component. All right, and that's filled with serous fluid. So the serous cavity is separating the parietal and visceral divisions of that membrane, okay, with serous fluid in between them. So let's see where those are. I think I'm really close to finding them. Oh, I don't have them in there? Why not? Oh, here they are. All right, so here is, part B over here. Here we have the oral cavity that's open to the outside world. So what kind of membrane lines the oral cavity? Mucous membrane. Same thing for nasal cavity. Same thing for trachea, right? That is a mucous membrane. And of course, maybe you could remember the kind of epithelium that covers the trachea. Anybody remember what we have in the trachea? That's that pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium, right? And it's got a special cell, that unicellular exocrine gland. It has cells in that epithelium that are secreting mucus. What's the name of that? Goblet cell, right? So here's a pretty good example of a mucous membrane that actually does secrete mucus, right? Because of that goblet cell right there. All right. Now for serous membranes, oh, that's a nice individual one. Let's look at this diagram right here. All right, so don't forget, how many parts does a serous membrane have? It's actually got three parts to it. Okay, three parts. So let's look at the pleural serous membrane first. So let's just really zoom in so that you can see this really nice. And it's probably got different colors. So here is a lung right here. That's a nice organ. Right on the surface of the lung, that kind of looks like fuchsia to me. What color is that?
Pink.
Pinkish. Okay. So notice that membrane is right on the surface of the lung. So is that going to be the visceral or parietal division? That is going to be the visceral part, right? So think of the lungs as viscera, part of the viscera, an internal organ. So the visceral part of that serous membrane is touching the lungs, right? And I hope this is a different color, but it kind of looks like it's the same color almost, right? Looks like the same. Now that is on the wall of the thoracic cavity. And that's the parietal division of that serous membrane. Okay. So you got the visceral membrane, the parietal membrane, and then here you have the serous cavity, which is the third structure of a serous membrane. And what is it filled with? Serous fluid, right? Which is a watery kind of substance. Okay. All right. So I just might ask you, since it's watery, is it sticky or slippery? Okay, I'm going to change your opinion of that sometime during the class. Water is actually pretty sticky. All right, and I'll maybe do some experiments. That helps glue the thoracic wall to the surface of the lung so that when your thorax expands, when you use muscles to expand your thorax, what does it do? It actually pulls on the lungs and helps inflate the lungs. Okay, so try to think of examples of how water is sticky, but I won't tell you about that today. All right, here is the heart. All right, so this is the pericardial cavity. It's not open to the outside world. So what kind of membrane do we have around the heart? That's a serous membrane, right? And how many divisions does a serous membrane have?
Three.
It's got three. The part that's right on the surface of the heart is called the visceral pericardium. The one that's on the wall of the cavity, we call that the parietal pericardium. And then you have this space right here, the pericardial space filled with serous fluid, and it's very similar to the fluid that you have in the lungs right here. So these membranes, we're going to look at, when we get to the heart, there's another one that's really strong. It helps suspend the heart in the pericardial cavity. Okay, and this space can be infected, right? The pericardial space right here can be infected, like the pleural space can be infected. And you should probably know what those conditions are called. What do we call it when somebody has an infection or maybe just an inflammation of some kind of the pericardial space? That's pericarditis. Yeah. And if somebody has an infection of this pleural space right here, we call that pleurisy. Anybody have, probably no one here has ever had pericarditis. But what about pleurisy? Anybody have pleurisy in here? Oh, that's really good because that's a pretty miserable condition. All right. When this space gets inflamed, whenever you try to take a breath, what has to happen to these membranes? They got to stretch, right? And when they get inflamed, it hurts really bad. It feels like somebody has a knife and is stabbing you in the chest, right? And hopefully no one's experienced that either, right? But that's really very, very painful. So what do you have a tendency not to do when you have pleurisy?
Breathe.
You don't feel like breathing because you don't feel like being stabbed in the chest. Well, tell me what's worse. Holding your breath for a couple hours or breathing when somebody's just stabbing you in the chest? Well, you're really, really miserable. You just don't know what to do, right? So how do we help patients in intractable pain? If they can't make up their mind because it hurts so bad to breathe, it hurts bad if they don't breathe, what do to help them? Okay, yeah, medicine, that's a really good thing. Well, opiates, right? So there are proper times when you prescribe or give patients very powerful drugs so that they can breathe. Okay, and of course you got to figure out what's causing that infection and treat the underlying cause as well. All right, when somebody has pericarditis, that's even worse than pleurisy. Oh, I was going to ask you what that inflammation of the pericardial space is right here. That's pericarditis. All right, that fills up with fluid, and as fluid builds up right here, okay, it has a tendency to compress the heart. So what's going to happen to heart function as the heart gets compressed?
Blood.
Yeah, so don't forget, what is the heart doing? It's contracting and it's pumping blood, right? And then it relaxes and then blood flows into the heart so that when it contracts again, it can pump blood out. But if this space is filled with fluid when the heart relaxes, guess what? There's no room for blood to flow into the heart because the space is all filled up with fluid so that when the heart does contract, it's hardly pumping any blood. So that's bad because if you have a heart that's pumping, you want it to pump blood, right? Not just kind of, it doesn't matter if it beats, it's actually got to pump blood. All right, so sometimes that fluid has to be taken out of this space rapidly, maybe rapidly from the pleural space, and, right, you just aspirate it out with a needle. Right, just jab somebody in the chest, aspirate it out, and guess how they feel? Better, just in a blink of an eye, right? So that's really nice. All right, so make sure you know all these different divisions of these membranes right here, because, of course, it's really, really important. Now, here is the third kind of serous membrane. Here is the, what, abdominal cavity, pelvic cavity down over here. Here is a membrane that lines the abdominal and pelvic cavity, so that's the parietal division. And notice that it is continuous and then develops covering the surface of the liver, right, and surface of viscera inside the abdominal and pelvic cavity, like the stomach and intestines. So this, what would you call this division right here? That's the visceral division, right, of the peritoneum, and here is the parietal peritoneum right here, filled with serous fluid in the peritoneal space. And of course, you can get an infection in this compartment as well, and you call that peritonitis. What's a really common way you can get peritonitis? Well, we didn't study digestive system yet, but there's some large intestine down here that has a little vestigial organ on it called the appendix. All right, and when that appendix bursts, all that inflamed, rotten, infected material goes into the peritoneum, and that's, you know, what's going to cause a peritonitis. Okay. All right, so this is a good place to start learning layers inside the body, right? Just by knowing these different membranes right here. All right, there are some other membranes. All right, so these are going to cover a surface. These are neither serous or mucous membranes. The cutaneous membrane is what we're going to talk about next, right? Cutaneous just means pertaining to your skin, the outside covering of your body. And that's a stratified squamous epithelium. You should know what that is already. And it has another deeper layer that's made out of some connective tissues, right? So the cutaneous membrane has different kinds of tissues that make it up. Another kind of membrane is a synovial membrane. And a synovial membrane is a membrane that's around certain kinds of joints in our body that are freely movable. We have joints that don't move, like in our cranium. They don't move. They don't have a synovial membrane. But other joints, like your elbow, wrist, shoulder, freely movable, they have a synovial membrane, and it secretes a synovial fluid, which is a lubricating kind of material. It's not like a serous fluid. It's lubricating. Now, that kind of fluid is slippery because it has different components in it. Another kind of membrane is the periosteum. When we see a prefix on a word peri, what the heck does that mean? Surrounding, right? Surrounding, usually on the outside, superficial surface. And whenever you hear that word osteo, what should you be thinking? Bone. So here is a membrane that is on the outside surrounding bones in our body. All right. And let me tell you something about what I mean by cortical surface. We have a number of different organs inside our body. And by structure, they are not the same on the surface compared to the deeper parts of that organ. Right? They have different components, then they might do different things. The cortical part of an organ is the superficial. Right? Cortex is superficial, while the medulla, right, is the deep part of the organ. And bones, we can look at that exact same way. Next week, we're going to start looking at some bones. The cortical bone is what? Superficial, right on the outside. And it's going to be different than medullary bone, which is deep inside the bone. Maybe you've heard of the adrenal gland, right? And that's another kind of organ that we understand that the adrenal gland is a lot different in the superficial region compared to the deeper regions, right? So we always talk about the adrenal cortex versus the adrenal medulla. It has different structure, so it has different functions inside the body. So cortex is what? Superficial. The periosteum has certain kinds of cells that build bone up. We're going to talk about what we call those cells. Maybe I'll tell you right now. Those are osteoblasts. You should be familiar with that because you hear what? Osteo, that's a bone kind of cell. Osteoblast builds bone. And bones also have another kind of membrane that lines all the cavities deep inside the bone, lines the medullary cavities. Medullary means what? What part of the bone? The deep part. Okay. It has a lining called the endosteum, and those mostly have a different kind of osteocyte in there that breaks bone down, and that's called an osteoclast. You don't have to know those names until we get into bone, but I thought I'd just mention them right now, just for fun. So blast builds bone, find that in the periosteum. The clast dissolves bone down. We find them primarily in the endosteum of bone. So here is an important concept in this class. And I usually don't introduce it till a little bit later on. But here we have two different kinds of cells. An osteoblast that builds bone up, right? And an osteoclast that breaks bone down. What do you call a system where you have two things that work against each other? Okay? Like you have a cell that builds bone and you have cells that break bone down. And why is that really a good thing? There's a term that's used to describe that kind of system. And it's probably the most important concept in this class, so I'm going to mention it a number of different times. All right, so think even of your automobile. What are the two things that you have in your automobile that gives you precise control and balance over your car that work in opposition to each other? The accelerator and the brake pedal. Would you ever think of driving your car without both of those working at the same time? Well, if the accelerator didn't work, it wouldn't matter, right, because you couldn't go anywhere. But you need to have both that are working against each other. Right, so we call that antagonism. So in your body, we have a number of antagonistic systems, things that work against each other, but as a result, you have precise control and balance over that part of your body. Right, so you have precise control and balance over your skeleton because you have osteoblasts and osteoclasts, and when they function together properly, even though they work against each other, you have a nice, healthy skeleton, which we all have in here. But we won't have that for our life, for our whole life, because that system kind of goes haywire every once in a while. Okay. Another interesting thing about the skeleton is that it doesn't last forever. Does anybody know how long your skeleton lasts? Or another way of thinking, how often do you have to rebuild your complete skeletal system? Every 5 years. Yeah, you guys are great. Every 5 years you have a completely new skeletal system because it's doing what all the time? It's being broken down and being rebuilt in the proper way for how you're using your body. Okay, so antagonism is a very important concept in this class. All right, so you know what? That's it for this particular chapter, unless somebody's got a question about mucous membranes, serous membranes, other kinds of membranes. Your book probably mentions a couple others. All right, that's all pretty interesting. Okay, so that takes us to chapter 5, all right, the integumentary system. What the heck is that? Skin. Okay, so the integumentary system is made up of skin plus accessory structures. We're going to look at a number of different organs that have some primary structures and accessory structures. And accessory structures are special structures that just help that organ do its job. Maybe not its primary function, but without those structures, right, the primary organ would be damaged somehow or couldn't take care of itself. All right, so integument is skin plus accessory structures like hair, nails, glands. Like, for instance, give me an example of a gland. Sweat gland cools you down. Yeah, we're going to look at a couple different glands. And there's actually a tiny, tiny muscle in your integument that operates when you're scared and when you're cold. What does it give you?
Goosebumps.
Yeah, a little tiny, tiny muscle associated with hair follicles. So when it contracts, it tries to shove a hair follicle out of your body, but it can't just jump out. It's trapped, but it forms that little pimple, little goosebump right there. Okay. All right, so the function of the skin. These are always really important to know, the different functions of various organs. Okay, a really good example of that is the kidney. What do you think the kidney does? Okay, it excretes waste products from our body, produces urine, but the kidney does all kinds of other things in your body. It helps regulate red blood cell production. It helps regulate your blood pressure. So I think it's really important that you become aware of all these different functions of organs, because in Western medicine, right, you have a tendency just to think of an organ and think that it only has one job. But an organ has many, many jobs, and you should really appreciate different organs, maybe from like a traditional oriental approach as well, right? So that's really cool. So what does the skin do for us? Okay, it protects internal structures from dehydration and infection. That's one of the prime functions of your integument. All right, but what else does it do? It helps regulate body temperature. And what can you tell me about your body temperature? Does it change very much? No, it shouldn't. Not if you're healthy, right? And it's your skin that does a huge job in regulating your body temperature. Anybody know what your body temperature is? Yeah, 98.6. You probably don't even have to measure it, right? That's pretty much constant, really constant for a lot of people. Okay. The integument is also important for producing vitamin D. A vitamin is a compound that you cannot synthesize in your body. You have to have it in your diet in order to keep you in a healthy state. If you don't have that particular vitamin, that will force you into a disease state. And this particular vitamin, vitamin D, is necessary for proper bone growth as well as absorption of calcium from your diet. So that's a huge important vitamin to have. And your skin helps produce a precursor for vitamin D. But you need some sunlight in order for that to happen. All right, so if you're just in a building all the time, don't get any sunlight, guess what you need? You need vitamin D in your diet, because the light and sun won't be helping make some derivatives of vitamin D that you need. All right, and something else that's pretty important too, sensation. Your integument is important for sensation. How so? What kind of sensations do you have on your integument? Like damaging kinds of stimuli. Ever pick up a hot frying pan or something, or touch something in the oven while you're reaching in there? Right, you have temperature receptors. And those will send pain signals to your brain to protect your body. All right, what else is that's not so painful? Cold, maybe. Okay, so that's another temperature receptor. Touch is really important. You have various kinds of touch. You have deep pressure, light pressure. As a matter of fact, some people can read with sensors that are in their fingertips that can respond to very light pressure. Okay, who can read? Anybody here, can you read with your fingertips? What would you read?
Braille,
for instance. Okay, so sensation is really important. These are ways that you can communicate with your environment, right? So when the wind is blowing, it blows over your hair and you feel those little hairs moving. Okay, so sensors are very important for communicating with your environment. All right, so let's talk about the skin in particular. Then we'll get to accessory structures a little bit later. There are two main layers that make up skin. And then a third layer that's deep to the skin that we talk about right now, even though it's not part of the integument. The most superficial layer is called the epidermis. The deeper layer is called the dermis. Right? So what does epi mean? Superficial to, right on top of the dermis. And hypodermis, right here, that means below the dermis. Right? So everything is kind of named after the dermis right here. Right, the epidermis is a typical stratified squamous epithelium. So what can you tell me about layers? It's got many layers, and we got to know the different layers in here and kind of what their functions are. Depending on the kind of skin it is, it's either going to have four layers or five layers. If it's thin, it's going to have four layers. If it's thick, it's going to have five layers, right? Okay. But it's an epithelium because it's what? It's covering a surface. All right, so let me find a pretty good picture of skin. I think I have a little video that you can listen to on this slide right here. All right, so here is a nice exam figure. So on the exam, make sure you know what where all these lead lines are going, and you can label all of these different structures in skin. All right, so the first thing we're talking about are layers. Let me move some of my equipment out of the way here so I don't keep clicking this all the time. All right, so the epidermis is the superficial layer, and notice here is a nice basement membrane that's going to separate the epidermis, which is superficial, from the dermis, which is deep within the integument. And then you have a layer that's underneath the dermis, and you can see that it has a lot of adipose in it, and that's what we call the hypodermis. That's not really part of the integument, but it's, since it's right there, we talk about it right now. The job of the hypodermis is just to connect your skin to other underlying structures that you have in your body, like muscle or bone, for instance. That's the job of the hypodermis. Oh, another job of the hypodermis, right, as you can see, is what? It stores? It stores fat. That's right. And fat is an energy molecule. Okay. All right, so here we see the epidermis and then the dermis. We're going to look at the different layers. We call it a stratified squamous because the cell shape on this apical surface are what? Squamous. These down here, the deepest layer right here, which we call the stratum basale, these are going to be more cuboidal or columnar, probably cuboidal. Okay. So let's start looking at the epidermis. All right, what are some layers of the epidermis? Here is a particularly nice slide that shows just the epidermis. Right, so nothing about the dermis. I see a little bit of dermis down over here. So remember, epidermis is what kind of tissue? It is an epithelium, right? It's an epithelium. So if I ask you tissue, just think of the four major kinds. It's an epithelium. And what kind of epithelium is it? Stratified squamous epithelium. And then here's the dermis. What kind of tissue is the dermis? That's a connective tissue, and we're going to talk about that in just a little bit. All right, so I see the different layers that make up the epithelium, which is, epidermis, which is an epithelium. Right here is the stratum basale. So the stratum basale is one, maybe two layers thick. All right, on this slide, I only see one layer thick right here. And this is the living layer of the skin, right? And it is signified by, or characterized by, mitosis. So these cells are undergoing mitosis. Can you see any cells that are undergoing mitosis right here? Right here. What phase of mitosis is that? That's nice metaphase, right? So these cells are undergoing mitosis. What's the function of mitosis again? Cell division. Well, cell division means mitosis. But so why are cells dividing? What are the two main reasons cells are dividing? Growth or to replace old and damaged cells, right? Okay, so these superficial cells here in this layer are dead. Long time ago dead. They're flaking off your body all the time. And so they have to be replaced. And what kind of process is necessary in order to replace these cells? Mitosis. So mitosis is happening in the stratum basale. And then they start to migrate up to the surface. And as they move from stratum basale up to the superficial layers called the stratum corneum, they actually die. Because what is one funny characteristic of all epithelia? It's really strange. And you're aware of it. It doesn't contain blood vessels, right? So you have blood vessels down here in the connective tissue, but as these cells move away, they move away from their supply of nutrients, from their supply of oxygen, and they just kind of die as a result of that. But that's no big deal because why? They're going to be replaced by other cells via this process of mitosis right here. All right, so those are the two layers, stratum basale, near the basement membrane, near the apical surface, the stratum corneum. And the stratum corneum is named because these cells are really hard. They're filled with a chemical compound that we call keratin. Don't get that confused with collagen. Where do you find collagen? Where do you find collagen? Connective tissue. What part of a connective tissue? It's in the matrix, right, which is what? The extracellular space. So collagen is extracellular. Keratin, on the other hand, it's a protein, might be sort of similar to collagen, but it's not extracellular. It is intracellular. It's inside these cells. And it's got to be because there really is no extracellular space to put keratin right here. So it's the job of these different layers right here, right, to build up keratin. So by the time these cells get up in this region right here, they're loaded with keratin, and it's like a little armor plating for your body. It protects your body from abrasion. Right, there are also glycolipids in between the cells right here. And what can you tell me about a lipid or an oil and water? Are they happy together? No, they don't. They don't mix at all, right? So these glycolipids actually form a permeability barrier to keep water inside your body, right? So that's why those glycolipids are there. So what other kinds of cells do we have right here? The cells that are producing keratin and end up in the stratum corneum, we call those keratinocytes. So a keratinocyte is a special cell filled with keratin. They originate from this basal region right here. Anybody ever hear of a basal cell carcinoma? Probably. That's a kind of carcinoma that develops from these keratinocytes down here in the stratum basale. All right, there's another kind of, and that's a basal cell carcinoma, not as dangerous as other kinds of skin cancer. Here's another kind of cell that can produce a very dangerous kind of cancer, but it performs a very important function in our body. This is a melanocyte. Now, what can you tell me about the color of this melanocyte compared to this basal cell right here? It's darker, right. So the melanocyte is actually producing a pigment. And that pigment is a brown to black color. And what the heck is a pigment? It's a chemical that produces some kind of color, which means that it's going to absorb light of some kind of color of light. So paints have pigments in them, lipstick, fingernail polish. These chairs have pigment in them. Okay. So pigment absorbs light energy of some kind. And if it's a yellow pigment, it just means that it absorbs all different wavelengths from the sun except yellow. It reflects yellow back at your eye, and that's how you can see it. All right. So if it's a really dark pigment, black to brown pigment, it's what? Absorbing all of the radiation from the sun so nothing gets bounced back to your eye. Right? And that's a very protective kind of pigment. That protects the deeper layers of your skin from the harmful rays from the sun, in particular ultraviolet light, which is so powerful that it can actually cause mutations in chromosomes. So the more melanocytes you have and the more active your melanocytes are, right, the more your skin is protected from sunlight. Okay, so melanin is the chemical that melanocytes produce, and it's a natural sunscreen. And guess what the most damaging thing that most people do to their skin is? Just go out in sunlight. Yeah, just being in sunlight is very damaging to the skin. So the more melanin you have, the younger your skin is going to last through your lifetime because you don't have to put on sunscreen all the time. Right? So you're kind of lucky in that regard. All right, there are some people that maybe have melanocytes, but they're missing an enzyme that's going to produce a melanin. And guess what their appearance is?
Albino.
Yeah, they're going to be completely white all over the place. White hair. Okay, their lips aren't going to be white. They're going to be pink because you can see blood through your lips, right? So your eyes might be pink, but no color. Your hair is going to be white. Your skin is going to be perfectly white. No matter what kind of ethnicity your parents are, you're going to have all the same physical characteristics, but you're going to be completely white. Now, what can you tell me about somebody that has albinism when they go out in the sun? What's going to happen to them? Yeah, it doesn't matter what your parents look like. You're going to burn to a crisp in just a couple minutes. Right, so you really got to protect yourself when that happens. Sunscreen and hats. And as a matter of fact, if you live in other, Los Angeles is pretty far south where the sun is pretty strong. Okay, but there are other countries that have even stronger sunlight, like Australia. And if you ever go out to Australia and see people outside, you probably never see them outside without a hat on. Okay, protecting themselves, their ears, their nose, their scalp, from skin cancer, because when these melanocytes start to misbehave, right, unless it's caught very, very early, I'm not up on the latest techniques, but the prognosis is really poor, okay? Melanoma, the prognosis is very, very poor for that. So always protect your skin, okay? Especially if you don't have many melanocytes right? If you're very pale in color, that's really hard on your skin. All right, so we got the basal cells, the melanocytes. Melanocytes also have these processes you can see moving up between the different cells. Another kind of cell that we see is a Langerhans cell. And a Langerhans cell is similar to a white blood cell. Anybody have a feeling for the function of a white blood cell in your blood, what its function is? It's immune response. It helps protect you from infection. And so that's the job of a Langerhans cell. It helps fight infection. I don't know how mobile these are in the skin, but you can see they can kind of squish between different cells, look for things that aren't there, right, like bacteria, fungi, viruses, things like that, and destroy them before they can get a foothold. Here is a Merkel cell. This is a special tactile cell for very light pressure, right? So this is the kind of cell that somebody who is going to read in Braille would use as they move their finger over Braille on a piece of paper. That's going to send electrical information to the sensory nerve, and then you'll be able to feel those I was going to call it a dimple. It's not a dimple. It's a little bump, tiny bump on the surface of paper. All right, so those are two layers. Let's fill in some of the other layers. All right, the next layer is what we call the stratum spinosum. All right, so that is superficial to the stratum basale. And keratin is starting to be produced in these cells. They change their shape a little bit. The cells get glued together and they start to deform. They form these little spikes. And so that's where the name comes from, spinosum. That's a spiky cell layer right here. All right, so, and they're still kind of alive. They're starting to produce a precursor molecule of keratin. And then these cells move up to the next layer right here. Now these cells right here are almost completely dead. The organelles are starting to deteriorate. There are vesicles or granules in here that contain lipid and a more perfectly formed chemical of keratin. And you can see the granules. So we call that the stratum granulosum. All right, and then as it moves up to the next layer, then the cells are completely dead. Keratin is completely formed. The glycolipid is outside the cells, right? And those are cells in the stratum corneum. So you got to know the layers, right? So the deepest layer is the basale. The next one is spinosum. The next one is granulosum. And then the next one is the corneum. Okay. All right, so that has four layers. What kind of skin has four layers? Okay, what kind of skin? We call it thin skin. We call it thin skin. Okay, there's another kind of skin that's called thick skin. It has an additional layer. It's really, really thin, but it's thick because the stratum corneum is probably about five times as deep, right? So we call that thick skin. So let's see if I can find a thick skin someplace. All right, here's your modeling lab is really good. Here's a picture, but if I blow this picture up so that you can see the different layers, it's going to get a little blurry. All right, so here we have thick skin on the left and thin skin on the right. And where are we going to find the epidermis? Look for basement membrane right here. All of this is dermis, so here is the epidermis that we're looking at. The first layer is the stratum basale, all right, and then we got the stratum spinosum, and then this highly pigmented region right here is the stratum granulosum, and then on top of that is the stratum corneum of all these dead flaky cells right here that are filled with, what are they filled with right here?
Keratin.
Keratin, yeah. Don't forget, that's intracellular. All right, if we look at thick skin, immediately you're going to see that the stratum corneum, right, from here to here, is what? Oh, it's more than five times as thick. That looks maybe 10 times as thick, right? So the stratum corneum is 10 times as thick. Here is the stratum basale, right here, basement membrane, attaching it to the dermis, right? So these are the different layers in the skin. So here is the stratum basale, right here. These are undergoing mitosis. So here is the stratum spinosum. right? And here we see the stratum granulosum, and then on top of the stratum granulosum, let me really zoom into this area right here, we see, we see a clear layer right here. That's the stratum lucidum. So in thick skin, you got that additional layer between the granulosum and the stratum corneum right here. It's called the stratum lucidum. Okay, and you guys get an impression of maybe some brownish look to these cells right here, in this region right here? Maybe. What kind of cells are going to be giving this layer kind of a dark color? The melanocytes, because they're producing melanin. Okay. All right, so that's pretty good for the epidermis. Let's look at the deeper layer. What's a deeper layer called?
The dermis.
And the dermis is made out of primarily two layers. And both of those are connective tissues, but different kinds of connective tissues. All right, here's the superficial region of the dermis. Here's the deeper region of the dermis. And the deep region has these really strong filaments running through it. What do we call these strong fibers?
Collagen.
Okay? And you're going to recognize immediately that this layer is kind of misnamed, because you might want to call this the collagenaceous layer, but it's not. It's called the reticular layer. It's reticular layer not because it has a lot of reticular fibers. It has collagen that's really, really strong. But these collagen fibers are going in all different directions, not parallel sheets. What do we call a connective tissue with collagen going in all different directions? It's dense but irregular, right? So the deeper layer right here, the reticular layer of the dermis, is dense, irregular connective tissue. It's strong because it has collagen. The next, the more superficial part of the dermis doesn't have a lot of collagen. It has some, but not nearly the same amount. It's areolar connective tissue. Right, it just helps attach the epidermis to the dermis right here. All right, and you know what? You guys are familiar with the different layers of the dermis already, because we use the skin from animals to produce a product that we use all the time, namely leather. All right, and leather is made up of one of these layers. Right? Is it the stratum corneum, lucidum, granulosum, spinosum, stratum basale, the papillary layer of the dermis, or the reticular layer of the dermis? It's the reticular layer, right? Because leather is tough. It's filled with collagen, right? So you can make shoes, nice leather coats, and things like that out of it. All right, so when leather is processed, all of these other superficial layers are rubbed away or let to rot off or whatever, somehow processed off, so you're left primarily with collagen. And collagen is and leather is pretty stable. Why is leather pretty stable? Because it really doesn't have cells in it. It doesn't have living material. It's not made of living material. It's made of what? The extracellular matrix, which is collagen. Okay. All right. Now, we call this the papillary layer right here because of these projections that kind of poke up from the dermis up into the epidermis right here. We call those papillae. Right, dermal papillae. And dermal papillae have a network of capillaries that poke up into these different regions right here, and that helps supply oxygen and nutrients to what? All these surrounding areas of the epidermis. And so we see these primarily in thick skin, but you can see dermal papillae even in thin skin. So let's think about what regions of your body has thick skin covering it. Okay, palms of your hands, soles of your feet, and that's pretty much it. Now, what other structures do you see on the palms of your hands?
Lines.
You see lines. What do we call those lines? Well, we call them fingerprints, right? Fingerprints, palm prints, toe prints, footprints, that kind of thing. Okay, but fingerprints. You have fingerprints because of these dermal papillae, and as they poke up into the epidermis, that shape kind of gets transmitted to the surface. I don't see it on this picture right here. And that forms fingerprints. So dermal papillae is the underlying reason why you have fingerprints where in thick skin, but not really in thin skin right here. Okay, so that's pretty important to know. All right, let me take a look at some of my slides. All right, so keratinocytes only can live for about 45 days.
They die, they got to be replaced by what kind of process? Mitosis. What layer is mitosis undergoing? Yeah, the basali layer, right? The deepest layer. All right, so don't forget, cells move from the stratum basali up to the stratum corneum. The stratum basali are cuboidal or columnar cells, and they turn into these squamous cells as they move up there. All right, and I think I talked about all this stuff already in there. All right, so next time maybe I'm going to start even by reviewing a little bit of the dermis. Okay, so make sure you do your prerequisite lecture reading this time. And next time, as you're walking in, I want to see your homework. Have it out. Okay? I want to make sure everybody's doing something to pass the class. All right? Because you'll have no chance if you start studying the night before the test. Oh, what do you call that when you start? Very nice. Very, very nice. What do you call that when you start studying the night before the test?
Training.
It's called procrastination. Yeah. Hi.
That's okay.